You know, usually when we talk about memory, especially historical memory, there is this this unstated expectation of preservation.
Right, we treat it like a museum archive.
Exactly. I mean, you open a history book, you see a date, you see a stark black and white photograph, and society collectively points to it and says, you know, there it is, that happened.
Yeah, it's treated as something entirely static, like it's just an artifact.
Right. It's fixed in time, it feels clean, safely contained in the past. Basically, behind a velvet rope.
And in a strange way, that containment is really comforting to us, you know?
Yeah.
We like history to be a lesson that we've already learned.
Oh, totally.
We want it to be a closed chapter that just sits quietly on a shelf, proving how far we have come as a society.
But then you step into the actual world of atrocity prevention, like the raw, bleeding edge of collective trauma, and suddenly you realize that archive is practically radioactive.
It really is.
We are looking at a landscape today where memory isn't just something we passively possess. It is something that actively operates in the present.
Right. It has a metabolism.
It
It does
does.
things.
Yes. And what it does is, honestly, it is highly complex, deeply consequential, and sometimes quite terrifying.
I mean, it is the absolute definition of a moral minefield. Because memory, in the context we are exploring today, is doing heavy lifting.
Yeah.
It is an active mechanism in our political and social systems. It's not just sitting there.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are incredibly glad you are here with us. If you are new to the show, our core mission, as always, is taking incredibly dense, complex sources, the kinds of things that usually stay locked in academic ivory towers, and extracting the most profound insights.
Which is exactly what we have today.
Yes, we want to give you the shortcut to being truly well-informed without burying you in information overload. And today, we are looking at a document that I promise you is going to fundamentally change how you view history.
Absolutely.
It will change how you consume the news and even how you interact with the technology you use every single day.
That is honestly no exaggeration. We are unpacking an incredibly dense, highly sensitive 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saihili.
Right.
It is titled No Wound Denied, No Wound Enthroned, Holocaust Memory, Genocide Prevention, and the Life-Coherent Ethics of Non-Disposability.
Okay, let's unpack this. Just to set the tone for you, before we get into the heavy philosophical architecture of this, I want to describe the cover art of this paper.
Oh, the visual is so important.
It really is because it captures the emotional and intellectual essence of what we are about to discuss. So imagine a broken stone ring. It looks heavy, ancient, like the ruins of a coliseum or an old monument.
I don't like rubble, yeah.
Right. But the broken, jagged edge of that stone transforms seamlessly into this beautiful, glowing, golden pathway.
It's a really striking contrast.
It is. And walking along this pathway, moving toward a bright rising sun, are these delicate silhouettes of people. You can see families, individuals, people holding hands.
One of them is holding an olive branch, right?
Yes, exactly. One figure is holding up an olive branch. And fading into the background behind them, almost like a ghost or an echo, you can see faint imprints of historical documents.
There's a Star of David in there, too.
Yeah, there is. And there's a single powerful quote stamped across the bottom that just says, "I want the world to know testimony."
It is a profoundly striking visual, and it perfectly encapsulates our overarching mission today.
It really does.
Because what Dr. Saihili is asking us to do with this paper is to interrogate the concept of memory itself. We are not just taking a historical tour here.
Right, we're asking a much sharper, much more uncomfortable question. Like, what does memory actively do to us right now?
Exactly. Does our collective memory of past atrocities serve as an active shield to protect the living today?
Or, and this is the controversial part, does it sometimes become a tool that is captured by institutions to shield power from accountability?
That is the core tension of the whole piece.
Now, before we really dive into the mechanisms of that, I want to pause and be incredibly clear with you, our listener. This source material touches on highly sensitive, deeply painful, and intensely politically charged modern conflicts.
It's very heavy material.
It is. Specifically, the paper deals directly with the ongoing situation involving Israel and Gaza. Our goal in this deep dive is absolutely not to take a side.
Right. We're remaining completely impartial.
Exactly. We are not here to endorse a specific political viewpoint. We are not here to advocate for any policy. And we are certainly not here to play judge or jury over decades of conflict.
I cannot stress that enough.
Yeah.
Our strict objective here is to act as your guides through the fascinating ethical frameworks, the philosophical models, and the specific terminology that Dr. Saily presents.
Right. We want to lay out these complex arguments completely impartially. The goal is just to give you the vocabulary to understand the underlying mechanics of how memory and power interact.
So you can evaluate the world for yourself.
Exactly. So with those necessary guardrails firmly in place, let's start with the hook that completely caught me off guard.
Oh, the AI part.
Yes. When you sit down to read a dense academic white paper on historical memory and genocide prevention, you probably do not expect the very first paragraph the authors note to be about artificial intelligence.
It's a brilliant way to open, though, because it grounds these lofty philosophical concepts in something we interact with literally every single day.
Right. So Dr. Saily was trying to create conceptual figures to put into the paper. He wanted to use frontier AI tools, you know, the really advanced modern image generators, to visually explain how a society progressively dehumanizes a specific group of people.
And his goal was purely educational, right?
Entirely. The entire goal was to create an educational warning. He wanted to show the mechanics of hate so people could learn how to spot it before it turns into mass violence.
And what happened when he prompted the AI is a perfect microcosm of the entire paper's thesis.
Tell him what happened.
The AI flat out refused. It either blocked the requests entirely due to its built-in safety restrictions, or it spit out these completely sterile, schematic, cartoonish substitutes.
Like clip art, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Images that conveyed absolutely none of the necessary historical or moral weight.
It is such a paradox. I mean, the system, which was specifically designed by its engineers to keep us safe from harmful content, actually prevented a genocide educator from illustrating the mechanisms of real-world harm.
Which brings us to a crucial foundational concept in the paper. Dr. Saily calls it procedural capture.
Procedural capture. Okay, break that down for us.
Right. So to truly grasp this, we need to look under the hood of how AI safety systems like text classifiers and image moderation algorithms are actually built.
They're built by corporations, right?
Exactly. They are optimized for corporations to avoid risk. They're built to avoid generating controversy, to avoid bad press, and ultimately to protect the brand reputation of the companies that own them.
So they operate on keyword sensitivity and automated context-blind risk avoidance.
Yeah, so the AI sees a prompt containing words like dehumanization, propaganda, or mechanisms of violence, and the system essentially panics.
It doesn't read the context at all.
Not at all. It just flags it as dangerous content and throws up a brick wall.
What's fascinating here is that the AI literally cannot distinguish between reproducing dehumanization, which would be, you know, creating actual hate speech or incitement, and critically exposing dehumanization.
Which is exactly what anti-genocide education requires.
Right. The system completely lacks the capacity to recognize what Dr. Saily calls life-coherent repair intentions. It just sees the radioactive topic and shuts the conversation down to protect itself.
And the paper extrapolates this outward in a really profound way. Because Dr. Saily argues this is not just a quirky glitch in Silicon Valley's code.
No, it's much bigger than that.
It is a civilizational problem. Because what happens when our massive human institutions, whether we're talking about tech platforms, academic gatekeepers, philanthropic funders, or corporate boards, what happens when they all optimize entirely for acceptability and compliance?
They completely flatten the moral context.
Exactly. You end up with a society that is optimizing for procedural safety rather than life-coherent safety.
In this environment, harm is avoided at the superficial level of content categories and PR statements. Right?
Yeah, but the deeper structural harm, the actual processes of human degradation happening in the real world, are left completely unchallenged.
Because merely discussing them, merely pointing at them, triggers the institutional safety filter. The language of repair is deemed too risky for the brand.
That's exactly it.
I was thinking about how to visualize this for you, and it's kind of like a fire alarm system in a crowded building that has been meticulously programmed to mute itself.
Okay, I like this. Go on.
Why? Because the loud, screeching sound of an alarm is considered too upsetting and disruptive for the building's occupants. So the system preserves the peace, it keeps everyone calm, but it lets the building burn to the ground.
That is a brilliant analogy, and it perfectly illustrates one of the foundational theoretical models in this paper, institutional autopoiesis.
Okay, autopoiesis. That is a heavy word.
It is, yeah. It was originally coined in theoretical biology by Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
To describe cells, right?
Right, to describe how living cells reproduce and maintain their own boundaries to survive. But Dr. Saheeli applies this biological concept to human institutions.
Oh, wow. So how does that map over?
Well, procedural capture happens when a system like a university, a tech company, or a government prioritizes its own self-preservation over the actual protection of human life it was theoretically built to serve.
So it protects its rules, its funding, its public relations, and its endowment above all else.
Exactly. So in the case of the author's note, the AI company successfully avoids a PR scandal on Twitter about generating disturbing images, but the educator is stripped of the tools needed to teach people how to spot the warning signs of mass violence.
The system saved itself, but it completely abandoned what the paper calls the life ground.
And we're going to use that term a lot today.
Yes, the life ground. It simply refers to the actual physical and moral conditions required for human life to survive and flourish.
Yeah, and this technological failure serves as a dark prologue for the rest of the paper. Dr. Saheeli is essentially asking, if our modern, highly advanced systems cannot even handle the basic language of diagnosing harm without shutting down in self-defense, how can we possibly rely on them to prevent real-world atrocities?
Which sets the stage for how the paper asks us to completely re-examine the ultimate historical rupture of the 20th century, the Holocaust.
Yes. Let's move into that historical grounding.
So the paper is incredibly deliberate in how it sets the definitions here. It formally defines the Holocaust as the systematic, state-sponsored persecution and murder of approximately 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany and its allies and collaborators.
Alongside the persecution and murder of millions of other targeted people, right?
Right. Including Roma, Sinti, disabled persons, and queer persons. But the paper immediately pushes us to move beyond our typical comfortable framing of this horror.
Because we have a psychological defense mechanism when we look back at the 1930s and 40s.
Oh, absolutely.
We often fall into the trap of thinking about the Holocaust as an eruption of primitive savagery. We narrate it as if society simply lost its mind, temporarily slipped back into the Dark Ages, and let the barbarians through the gates.
But Dr. Saheeli makes a crucial, chilling counterargument. The Holocaust did not happen outside of civilization. It happened inside civilization.
That's the scary part.
It was not a breakdown of modern institutions. It was the enthusiastic utilization of modernity's highest capacities.
That is the part that keeps you awake at night. I mean, law, medicine, transportation logistics, bureaucratic accounting, industrial production. They didn't fail.
No, they functioned flawlessly.
They were just optimized for destruction instead of creation.
Precisely. And this introduces the paper's concept of delifing. We often think of genocide as just the physical act of mass killing.
Right, the final moment.
Yeah, but the paper argues that genocide is a sequential, highly organized, bureaucratic process of removing a specific group from the shared moral world long before a single bullet is fired.
Let's really take our time and walk through this sequence of delifing, because it's the core of how atrocities actually manifest.
Okay, where does it start?
Well, before the sequence even begins, there has to be a violation of what Dr. Saheeli calls the principle of non-disposability.
Non-disposability, meaning you can't throw people away.
Exactly. This is the foundational ethical baseline, the absolute principle that no human group, anywhere, for any reason, may be treated as waste, as contamination, or as collateral residue.
Because the exact moment a society accepts that one specific group is disposable, the machinery of delifing is plugged in and powered up.
Yes, and the paper outlines exactly how this machinery operates step by step. Step one is mythic accusation.
So you don't just say a group is a political rival.
No, you elevate them to a cosmic enemy. You blame them for the underlying rot of society.
And the paper emphasizes how crucial this was regarding the Jewish centrality of the Holocaust. Jews were not targeted merely as political dissidents.
You know, the anti-Semitic mythology casts them as a supernatural threat.
Right. They were blamed for Germany's defeat in World War I, for economic ruin, for the spread of communism, and simultaneously for the evils of capitalism.
They were blamed for the anxieties of modernity itself.
Which leads directly to step two, right? Moral separation.
Exactly. Once they are the cosmic enemy, you have to mentally categorize them as something fundamentally other than human. You cut the ties of neighborly empathy.
And that paves the way for step three, which is where the bureaucracy really steps in legal degradation.
I think this is where our modern minds struggle. We forget that the Holocaust was entirely legal under German law at the time.
Yeah, the Nuremberg Laws didn't just happen overnight. It was a slow, methodical stripping of citizenship, the banning of intermarriage, pushing people out of civil service.
It had stamps, it had signatures, it had court rulings backing it up.
And that legality provides the psychological cover for step four, material dispossession.
This is the economic engine of de-lifing.
Right. The state and the citizenry begin systematically stealing from the targeted group. We are talking about the Aryanization of Jewish businesses, freezing bank accounts, taking homes.
Down to the level of stealing bicycles and radios.
The law makes the theft feel like a civic duty rather than a crime.
Which is terrifying. Then you move into step five, spatial concentration. Forcing the dispossessed into ghettos or transit camps.
You remove them from the public square so the rest of society doesn't have to look at the consequences of the laws they just supported.
Which brings us to step six. And this is perhaps the most uniquely terrifying aspect of modernity administrative normalization.
Explain that one, because it sounds so benign.
Right. This is where the cruelty just becomes the daily grind. It becomes paperwork. It's the train dispatcher making sure the rail cars arrive on time. It's the accountant tallying the gold extracted from the victims.
The horror is completely abstracted into spreadsheets and quotas.
And finally, that normalization allows for step seven, elimination, the physical destruction of the people.
Followed by step eight, erasure, where the state tries to hide the evidence, or worse, justify the act as a necessary defense of the nation.
So what does this all mean? When I read the sequence, I had to stop and process it.
Yeah, it's a lot.
We are culturally conditioned to think of genocide as pure, chaotic, irrational hatred. Mm. We picture a frenzied mob mentality.
Right. But the text argues it is actually highly orderly. It relies on clerks who pack a lunch and go to work, on train schedules, on property deeds. Doesn't that contradict how we fundamentally view the concept of evil?
It absolutely shatters our cinematic view of evil, and it draws heavily on philosopher Hannah Arendt's famous ideas about the banality of evil.
Oh, right, the banality of evil.
But the paper takes it further. Mm. If we connect this to the bigger picture and bring back that concept of institutional autopoiesis we discussed with the AI, it explains why evil isn't always chaotic.
A death system can be incredibly organized, efficient, and even deeply patriotic.
Exactly. When a society replaces moral judgment with administrative function, ordinary, supposedly good people can participate in catastrophic harm simply by following procedures, obeying the law, and doing their jobs well.
They aren't waking up deciding to be monsters. They are just filling out the ledger, hitting their departmental quotas, trying to get a promotion.
They trust the system, but the law itself has become, in the paper's terms, life incoherent.
And to truly understand how an entire society gets to that point of life incoherence without rebelling, Dr. Siley asks us to look at the machinery of disposability and ask two very dangerous, highly analytical questions.
Qui bono, which means who benefits, and qui malo, which means who is harmed.
Now, I want to note that the paper is extremely careful with how it deploys qui bono.
Yes, very careful.
Because asking who benefits from a massive historical tragedy can very quickly slide into the territory of terrible anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, the idea of a shadowy cabal pulling strings.
And Dr. Siley explicitly warns against that.
Right. Instead, the paper strictly looks at institutional, structural, and sociological functions. It asks, what overarching systems were served and stabilized by making a specific group of people disposable?
And the breakdown of beneficiaries in the Nazi system is deeply illuminating because it shows how wide the complicity spread.
Okay, let's go through them. Who is number one?
First, you have the Nazi Party state itself. By manufacturing a mythic internal enemy, they managed to unite a severely fractured, economically humiliated country.
They vastly expanded their own emergency police powers under the guise of public safety.
Exactly. Second, and this is a profound psychological point, you have the Aryan included, the ordinary citizens who fit the state's racial criteria.
What did they get out of it?
They gained a counterfeit sense of dignity. The paper argues that they received a feeling of belonging and superiority that was generated entirely through the exclusion and degradation of their neighbors.
Wow.
Yeah, if you feel like a failure in life, but the state suddenly tells you that you are part of an elite master race just by existing, that is a powerful, intoxicating benefit.
It is the ultimate psychological wage.
Right. Third, you have the sheer material theft, the property transfer system.
We have to be honest about this. Genocide is incredibly lucrative for the perpetrators.
It is.
Jewish homes, successful businesses, priceless art, massive bank accounts, All of it was expropriated and redistributed to the in-group. That buys a lot of loyalty.
Fourth, the broader war economy benefited directly from the horrific exploitation of forced labor. Major corporations built immense wealth on the backs of disposable humans who were worked to death.
And fifth, bureaucratic power expanded massively. The reach of the local police, the civil courts, the census systems, all of these mundane government agencies grew in authority, prestige, and budget.
Precisely by managing this massive system of classification and destruction.
And finally, you have imperial expansion, using the physical destruction of populations to clear living space for conquest.
So when you look at it structurally, you have all these distinct systems, the political, the economic, the psychological, the bureaucratic, achieving a kind of terrifying synergy.
They are working together smoothly. They are autopoietically feeding each other.
But the paper contrasts this sharply with Qui Malo, who was harmed.
Right, the victims.
Obviously, and primarily Jews as Jews, alongside the other targeted groups who were systematically murdered. But Dr. Saley points out that the harm rippled out to consume the life ground itself.
Europe as a continent lost irreplaceable moral, cultural, and spiritual worlds.
Entire lineages of thought, vibrant languages, immense scientific and artistic potential, gone forever in ash.
And the text makes a crucial point about the perpetrators themselves. By engaging in this, the perpetrators fundamentally harmed their own humanity.
They willingly destroy their own capacity for empathy, truth, and basic moral judgment.
Which leads to the terrifying conclusion Dr. Saley draws about this historical phase. The system achieved what the paper calls malevolent coherence.
Malevolent coherence. That is one of those phrases that just sticks with you.
Let's really unpack what that means.
It means the society functioned flawlessly to conserve its own internal logic. It conserved its racial hierarchy, its manufactured national innocence, and its imperial ambition.
So it was highly coherent internally. The trains ran on time, the laws were followed.
Right. But externally, morally, it was completely life incoherent. It literally consumed the life ground required for humanity to exist.
It was a well-oiled, perfectly engineered machine driving cheerfully off a cliff.
Exactly. Which naturally brings us to the aftermath.
Right. Once the war ends, once the machinery of delicing is violently stopped, how does humanity process what just happened?
How do we remember it?
Because Dr. Saheeli's central thesis is that memory itself is not neutral. Memory can either be a life-coherent tool, or it can suffer from the exact same institutional capture that the AI safety filter suffered from.
This is where we transition into what the Popper calls the pathologies of memory. Dr. Saley outlines two distinct, opposing ways a society can institutionalize the memory of a massive tragedy.
Let's start with the ideal. The first is life-coherent memory.
This is a type of memory that actively works to sustain the life ground.
It conserves historical truth without distortion. It conserves deep, unconditional mourning for the specific individuals lost.
And crucially, it conserves warning. It uses the past to expand the circle of protection in the present.
Right. Under a life-coherent framework, the Holocaust is correctly recognized as historically particular to Jews. It happened to them in a specific, unique context of deep-seated European anti-Semitism.
That specificity is never erased.
But simultaneously, its moral warning is recognized as universal for all of humanity. The lesson extracted is never again for anyone.
In this state, memory acts as a shared global immune system against the logic of disposability.
Its memory is an active defense mechanism for the vulnerable. But then the paper outlines the second way captured memory.
This happens when the sacred, painful memory of a wound is captured by structural power.
Like an institution or a nation state.
Yeah, institutions, nation states, or political movements can begin by serving the truth of the victims. But over time, autopoiesis takes over.
They end up using the memory of the victims to sanctify their own present-day legitimacy and policies.
And this leads directly to the striking title of the paper.
Yeah.
No Wound Denied, No Wound Enthroned.
Let's break that down piece by piece. A denied wound is fairly easy to understand.
Right, when a society refuses to acknowledge past suffering, or engages in outright distortion, minimization, or denial, it festers.
The victims are re-traumatized. It leads to deep resentment, social dissociation, and almost guarantees the repetition of violence because the root cause was never addressed.
Exactly. Denial is a violent act of erasure. But an enthroned wound, this is a much more complex and dangerous pathology of memory.
Here's where it gets really interesting and honestly highly provocative. Think about how we treat diplomatic immunity. I want to pitch this analogy to you, the listener.
It's a good analogy.
Imagine you have been granted this incredibly elevated, protected diplomatic status because of a horrific, unspeakable tragedy your people endured in the past. The world recognizes your vulnerability and gives you a shield.
Okay.
But decades later, that status is being used as an invisible shield to prevent you from ever getting a speeding ticket. Or worse, it is being used to justify crashing your car into someone else's house without any consequence.
That analogy hits the nail on the head.
The paper says an enthroned wound becomes inherently incapable of ethical reciprocity.
Yes, an enthroned wound is the ultimate defensive posture for a state or an institution. The logic of an enthroned wound says, because we suffered so immensely, because our historical trauma is so unique and absolute, we can no longer be judged by normal ethical standards.
Any violence we commit today is defensive by definition because we are perpetually the ultimate victims.
Therefore, the suffering of those we harm is either a tragic necessity, secondary, or perhaps even deserved because they are threatening our survival.
It is using the sacred memory of ultimate victimization as a permanent license for impunity in the present.
And the paper makes a point to note that this mechanism isn't unique to just one group or one conflict. We see this historically across the globe.
Yeah, colonized peoples who win their freedom can sometimes sacralize revenge against minorities. Formerly oppressed liberation movements can become deeply oppressive state regimes.
They use their history of struggle to silence any internal dissent. It is a universal human vulnerability to capture memory and weaponize it this way.
Dr. Sapila relies heavily here on the sociologist Johann Galtung's concept of cultural violence, right?
Yes. Cultural violence occurs when symbols, myths, or even sacred, legitimate memories of trauma are manipulated to make structural or direct violence appear normal, justified, or even holy.
Captured memory becomes a lethal form of cultural violence when it is utilized to mute the suffering of others.
It actively creates a hierarchy of human worth, where the lives of the in-group are infinitely grievable, and the lives of the out-group are rendered ungrievable and disposable.
We are wading into incredibly heavy, dense philosophical territory here. And to apply this framework safely and accurately to the modern day, which the paper does, Dr. Sigley sets up very strict, very clear academic guardrails.
We have to, yeah.
To navigate this without falling into prejudice or dangerous generalizations, we have to understand the crucial distinctions the author draws, specifically regarding the reality of anti-Semitism.
This is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
The paper relies on internationally recognized frameworks to define these boundaries.
Which ones specifically?
It cites both the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism, and the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, the JDA.
Okay, so what do they say?
The text is completely unambiguous on this point. Anti-Semitism is real, it is historically lethal, and it is a rapidly growing present-day threat.
It includes dangerous conspiracy myths about Jewish power, it includes Holocaust denial, and critically, it includes the act of holding Jewish people collectively responsible for the actions of the Israeli state.
The paper explicitly demands that Jewish life must be protected from anti-Semitism at all costs. It is a non-negotiable requirement of the life ground.
But while setting that boundary, Dr. Sakely introduces a brilliant analytical framing of two major catastrophic errors that modern society constantly makes when debating these issues.
The text refers to them as the two collapses.
And the word collapse is perfect here because it describes the flattening of necessary nuance.
Let's look at the first one, the anti-Semitic collapse.
Right.
This is the morally bankrupt, deeply prejudiced error of treating Jewish people everywhere across the globe, or Judaism as a religious and cultural tradition, as collectively responsible for the military, political, or administrative actions of the modern state of Israel.
If an institution or a person does that, they are engaging in the very logic of disposability by assigning collective guilt.
Exactly.
Now, the second error is what the paper calls the immunizing collapse.
This one is just as important.
This is the error of treating a legitimate, evidence-based criticism of Israel's state violence or philosophical criticism of the political ideology of Zionism as an inherent manifestation of hatred against Jews.
Dr. Sokoli argues that both of these collapses completely destroy our capacity for moral clarity.
Because if a society commits the anti-Semitic collapse, it makes Jewish people inherently unsafe worldwide.
And if a society commits the immunizing collapse, it makes Palestinians inherently unsafe by building a semantic wall that shields state violence from international accountability.
The paper asks us, demands of us, really, to hold multiple complex truths simultaneously. This is the essence of the life coherent position.
Actively protecting Jewish life from the real threat of anti-Semitism and actively protecting Palestinian life from the machinery of disposability are absolutely not rival moral projects.
No, they are not a zero-sum game.
They are required by the exact same ethical law. A world that uses one protection to cancel out or invalidate the other is, in Dr. Saley's words, morally disordered.
It requires a tremendous amount of intellectual discipline. It demands that we mentally separate categories that political rhetoric constantly tries to blur together.
We must distinguish between a diverse global people, a thousands of years old religious tradition like Judaism, a modern 19th and 20th century political nationalist ideology like Zionism, and the specific policy actions of a current government apparatus.
You can fiercely hold a state accountable to international human rights law without hating a people.
In fact, the paper argues that true, life-coherent memory requires you to hold states accountable.
I want to pause here again just for a second to explicitly remind you, our listener, of the objective stance of this deep dive. We're exploring the architectural framework that Dr. Saley has built.
Right. This framework argues that confusing these categories is the precise mechanism that allows memory to be captured, enthroned, and weaponized.
The author is handing us a diagnostic tool to examine how language, memory, and rhetoric are used by large institutions to evade ethical scrutiny.
And Dr. Saley does not leave this as a theoretical exercise. That diagnostic tool is immediately and forcefully applied to what the paper considers the most pressing moral stress test of our current time.
Which brings us to how the paper addresses the conflict in Gaza. Now, the text states very clearly, right up front, in bold terms, Gaza is not Auschwitz.
That is a vital distinction.
Absolutely. The paper strongly warns against making crude, lazy historical equivalencies or using the Holocaust merely as a dramatic metaphor for modern suffering.
The Holocaust was historically specific in its intent, its industrial scale, and its ideological underpinnings.
However, the paper views the situation in Gaza as the ultimate moral stress test of the post-WWII international order and the phrase, never again.
It asks a piercing question. Does never again function as a universal, binding obligation to prevent atrocity wherever it occurs, or has it been procedurally captured to function only as conditional tribal protection?
To answer that question, Dr. Saley looks at the immense friction between what we can call the legal timeline and the moral timeline.
Yeah, the paper documents the facts on the ground as of its publication in mid-2026.
What are the facts it lays out?
It notes that South Africa brought a historic case against Israel at the International Court of Justice under the Genocide Convention. It notes that the ICJ ordered provisional measures multiple times throughout 2024 to protect the civilian population.
And it also mentions the UN Commission, right?
Right. Separately, it notes that a UN Commission concluded in September 2025 that Israel had committed acts of genocide, a finding that the Israeli government firmly and categorically rejects.
But Dr. Saley makes a profound philosophical point about our societal reliance on the slow gears of the law. The paper argues that ethically, we cannot wait for perfect retrospective legal certainty before we act to protect human life.
By the time an international court makes a final, undisputed historical ruling, which, you know, often takes a decade or more, the people are already dead, the cities are already rubble, the culture is already erased.
As the text memorably puts it, prevention is not a postmortem activity.
If the life-coherent memory of the Holocaust means anything at all, it means that the early warning signs of de-lifing forced mass displacement, engineered starvation, the systematic destruction of medical infrastructure, and the rampant use of dehumanizing rhetoric by state officials must be acted upon before the final legal adjudication is complete.
Waiting for absolute bureaucratic consensus before intervening is precisely how the international community fails at prevention every single time.
At the exact same time, the paper is unequivocally clear about the events that sparked this specific horrific escalation of violence.
It explicitly, without caveat, condemns the October 7th Hamas attacks.
Yes. The intentional killings of civilians, the horrific hostage-taking the paper, categorizes these as absolute violations of the life protective order.
It does not romanticize violence. The paper refuses to excuse atrocity when it is committed by the oppressed, just as it refuses to excuse massive state atrocity committed under the banner of retaliation.
Both actions fundamentally violate the principle of non-disposability.
Which introduces one of the most beautiful and difficult concepts in the paper equal grievability.
A life-coherent ethical framework demands that all civilian life, regardless of nationality or religion, is infinitely grievable.
A dead Jewish child in a kibbutz and a dead Palestinian child in a bombed apartment building do not belong to competing moral universes.
We must possess the moral bandwidth to mourn both without placing conditions or whatabouts on our empathy.
Okay, I want to push back on this a little bit, playing devil's advocate for the listener who might be thinking about how their own workplace or university handles this.
Sure, let's hear it.
You have major respected institutions, Ivy League universities, corporate boards, and even national governments who issue statements saying, "We are staying neutral. This is too complex. We are waiting until the international courts make a final ruling before we take a stance."
Right. That happens all the time.
If an institution is genuinely trying to be neutral and waits for the final international court ruling before speaking out, isn't that just being responsible, measured, and objective in a chaotic world?
It sounds incredibly reasonable on its face. But if we connect this to the bigger picture and look back at the concept of institutional autopoiesis that we started with, Dr. Sarah Lee would argue that this neutrality is a fatal, self-serving illusion.
Really? How so?
The paper forcefully argues that institutional neutrality, in the face of highly credible, documented evidence of mass civilian destruction, is rarely about objectivity. It is almost always about institutional self-protection.
They are protecting their massive financial endowments. They are protecting their delicate political alliances.
They are protecting their donor relationships and their board members' comfort.
They are employing procedural capture, just like the AI filter.
Exactly. They use the lack of a final 10-year legal ruling as a convenient procedural excuse to avoid the immediate, uncomfortable, life-coherent duty of prevention.
They optimize for their own reputational safety, not the physical safety of the vulnerable populations being destroyed.
The paper points out that when international law is treated as a rigid performance that immediately binds our geopolitical enemies, but is infinitely suspended and debated for our geopolitical allies, until it is politically convenient, then it ceases to be law.
It degrades into mere geopolitical narration.
Which leads us to a very dark, very sobering vision of where all of this is currently heading.
In examining what the near future holds if we don't change course, Dr. Sarah Lee describes the path we are currently accelerating down as technologically advanced barbarism, or the rise of the autopoietic security state world.
It is a chilling description because reading it, it feels so viscerally present. It doesn't feel like sci-fi. Feels like the evening news.
What does this world look like?
Well, this world is characterized by several distinct features. First, selective legality, where the rules of war only restrain the weak, while the powerful act with complete impunity.
Second, the massive expansion of remote warfare. We are talking about the integration of AI targeting systems, autonomous drones, and digital surveillance.
This technology vastly increases a state's capacity to kill at scale, while completely decreasing the felt moral responsibility of the human being pulling the trigger from a computer screen thousands of miles away.
And it includes a phenomenon the paper calls humanitarian theater. We see this constantly now.
Oh, yeah. This is where an institution or a state loudly publicizes a tiny aid corridor or airdrops a few pallets of food, generating great PR footage, while those actions exist right alongside massive systemic policies that are actively destroying the fundamental conditions of life for millions of people.
It is the hollow appearance of care, designed specifically to mask the grinding machinery of disposability.
Furthermore, in this emerging autopoietic world, we see the deliberate, systematic criminalization of moral witness.
When students, journalists, doctors, or scholars speak out, when they try to accurately name the atrocity they are witnessing, they are immediately smeared, professionally disciplined, or blacklisted.
The sacred memory of past trauma is actually converted into a blunt security doctrine used to discipline anyone who questions present-day state violence.
It's a heavy, heavy diagnosis. But thankfully, the paper does not leave us abandoned in this dark place.
No, it doesn't.
Dr. Salili shifts in the final sections to the world that could be. A better world. And the incredible thing is, the key to unlocking this better world isn't to abandon Holocaust memory or to forget the past.
The key is to actually fulfill its deepest promise.
To shift the global paradigm permanently from never again for us to never again for anyone.
Dr. Salili outlines several profound, necessary transformations to bring this life-coherent world into existence.
First, we must collectively move from exclusive memory to reciprocal memory.
This means we must fiercely honor specific historical wounds. We do not flatten them. We do not erase the Jewishness of the Holocaust or the specific horrors of other genocides.
But we absolutely refuse to let those memories create a hierarchy of human worth today.
Jewish suffering is honored deeply as Jewish suffering. Palestinian suffering is honored deeply as Palestinian suffering, without one ever being used to cancel the other out.
Second, we have to radically transform our concept of national security. The paper argues we must move from a paradigm of security as domination to a paradigm of security as mutual survivability.
You simply cannot build the safety and flourishing of one people upon the permanent disposability, occupation, or subjugation of another.
It defies the life ground. It doesn't work practically, and morally, it just guarantees endless brutal cycles of future violence.
And third, we must move from mere static commemoration to active kinetic repair.
Memory cannot just be bronze statues, museum archives, and solemn annual ceremonies where politicians read prepared speeches.
It must be an active tool used to protect currently vulnerable life in real time.
If a Holocaust memorial does not make us infinitely more sensitive to the people being systematically dehumanized and destroyed today, then the paper argues it is not a memorial at all.
It is just ritual insulation.
Before we close, I want to mention that the paper also briefly but incredibly powerfully touches on the theological implications of all this. It challenges all major religious traditions directly.
Dr. Sotheli states that a God who is invoked to protect only one specific people's children while authorizing the destruction of another's is an idol of the tribe.
That is a profound, earth-shaking indictment of religious nationalism.
The text calls on Christians, Jews, Muslims, and secular humanists alike to deeply examine their own sacred narratives and historical traumas.
The spiritual test the paper offers is devastatingly simple. Do your sacred memories enlarge your capacity for universal mercy, or do they narrow your circle of concern to only protect your own in-group?
If the memory of your past suffering is used to justify the crucifixion of another people today, that memory has been desecrated by power.
Wow. As we wrap up this incredibly intense, demanding journey, let's take a breath and recap the massive territory we've covered for you.
We really went everywhere.
We started by looking at how our very tools like AI safety filters can be blinded by procedural capture, preventing us from even diagnosing the mechanisms of harm.
We unpacked how the Holocaust was not ancient savagery, but a highly modern, incredibly bureaucratic, multi-step process of delifing that utilized the very tools of civilization.
We explored the terrifying reality and logic of enthroned wounds, where past trauma is captured by institutional power to grant immunity from present-day accountability.
And we applied this entire life-coherent framework to the agonizing moral stress test of Gaza, recognizing the absolute necessity of equal grievability and the urgent overriding duty of prevention over comfortable institutional neutrality.
And we did all of this while holding tight to the necessary ethical distinctions that protect us from the dual dangers of collective blame on one side and the shielding of state violence on the other.
We stood firmly not on a political side, but on the side of human non-disposability.
And this framework connects directly back to your daily life long after this deep dive ends.
The next time you listen to a political speech or watch a sanitized news broadcast or even interact with a corporate policy or an AI chatbot, you now have a new diagnostic tool.
You can ask yourself, is this system, is this rhetoric, or is this invocation of memory actually protecting human life, the life ground?
Or is it just autopoetically protecting its own rules, its own identity, its own funding, and its own prestige?
We want to leave you with one final thought to mull over as you go about your day, building on everything we have discussed. Think about our modern world.
If our vast memorials, our billion-dollar museums, and our exhaustive history books are doing their jobs perfectly, well, wait, I shouldn't say perfectly. If we've truly mastered the art of remembering the atrocities of the past,
why do we feel the desperate, exhausting need to look away from the news today?
It's the ultimate question. What if the truest, most profound way to honor the memories of the victims we hold sacred isn't by building a higher, thicker, more heavily guarded wall around their legacy to keep them safe,
but by taking those memories down from the pedestal, taking them out of the archive, and using them as a lantern to spot the people who are standing in the dark, vulnerable and terrified right now? Thank you so much for joining us on this incredibly deep dive. Take care of yourselves. Keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you next time.